So this is a Java talk that has a complete set of lecture notes about the language Java and some of its capabilities. We find it particularly interesting for developing web applications because of its close interaction with writing user interfaces for web pages, and also with its ability to easily do distributed applications across the network. It has all of those capabilities built in fairly closely. In this class, we are not going to be doing the Java language in any kind of detail. We don't have enough time because we are going to be surveying lots of different web technologies that Professor Fox talked about in the first lecture. However, some of those technologies, like the database connection, we're going to cover the database connection that is given for Java, so it will be so you really need to have a background in sort of the Java language a little bit, enough to be able to write some simple programs. When Java got started, the first browser that did Java was called Hot Java. So some of you may have heard of that. And the original Hot Java browser was for the alpha version of the Java language. A lot of people wrote applets. It got to be popular. Then Java came out with the beta version of language, which was pretty different. That's what we've been using now for a year. And in fact, the Hot Java browser for the beta version of the language didn't come out until last summer. So it's a completely new implementation. But we haven't been having a lot of experience with that because meanwhile people have been using Netscape for their browser. I don't think this is doing the pages in quite the right order. Did it just skip one page, or did it skip more than one? Well, anyway. So Hot Java, the Hot Java browser is a complete toolkit for developing browser-style applications where you really want to be able to customize the user interface in a very flexible way. It had a lot of classes to use with Java that were very powerful for building user interfaces. Meanwhile, since Hot Java didn't come out for a while, people have been using Netscape with JavaScript to customize user interfaces. In fact, this particular interface with the frames and so on is done using JavaScript, and that's going to be the next section in the course after Java. Is going to be a section on JavaScript. I can't get this window resized. Oh well. I think most of the slideshows, except for a little bit at the bottom there. So I apologize for that. Let me try again. Oh, there we go. Can you see? down at the bottom there? Are you able to see that whole slide? Okay. I guess I can move it a little bit. Left side that you can't see, right? There, now can you see everything? Oh, but this side is different. Oh, you're getting a different picture. I can't optimize it for all the screens. Anyway, so how does Java work to provide a user interface to the World Wide Web? Well, Java is a general-purpose, object-oriented language that you can write programs in. And there is a compiler. You can write ordinary programs like C, like you would in C or C++. There is a compiler so that you compile your Java code. And what you produce are these applet codes, or so-called byte codes, which are the same for every machine that they're going to run on. The applet codes are then stored in the document space of a web server. Then anybody with a browser, such as Netscape or HotJava, can request to have one of those Java applets sent to the browser as part of their web page. The applet code then is sent to the browser just like a web server would serve up any other document to the client, like a .html file or something. However, it knows it's an applet because it has a different extension. So then there is an interpreter associated with the browser which runs the Java code on the client machine. So this enables Java to write user interfaces in which you can do mouse actions and buttons and so on, very flexibly do lots of windowing things and drawing, as well as other parts of the language, because the code can run directly at the browser and doesn't have to, you know, responses to what the user does doesn't have to be sent over the network to the web server and back, like with most HTML. So let's just take a quick glimpse at how you do that, and there is a special HTML tag that you can put on any HTML page in the web server document space, and this tag is called applet. I guess I can use the mouse here as a pointer. You can see that the name of the tag is applet. One of the things that you give is the attribute code, which tells it the name of the Java code that you want to have executed on the browser. You can also say what directory it's in, that's this code base attribute, and you can say what the width and height of the browser window that you want to show it in. So when you want to write a Java applet, you write the Java code, you compile it, you write an HTML file that refers to that applet, you put all of that in your web space, and then you can use a browser to look at it. There's actually another way to do it for debugging purposes, which is that you can compile the code and use, without using a web server, use something called the Applet Viewer to look at your Java code. So how did Java get started? I'll just say a few, I better just say a brief word about that because we don't have much time to talk about Java. But it was started by a group at Sun. They were originally working on writing a simpler version of C++ that would work as an operating system for consumer electronic boxes. And they actually developed a product called a personal digital assistant, which was a little control that you could carry around with you in your house and control all your electronics devices and your lights and so on. However, this project wasn't funded, and they went back to Sun, and by that time the World Wide Web had become very popular, and they realized that the capabilities that they had put into Java were also very suitable for use on the web. As I said before, the Hot Java browser was published, and people made free, and people used it. It became popular. Netscape then licensed Java, and finally the new version of the language, which is the version we're using now, the so-called beta version, was released in the Java development kit. Java has become fairly widely accepted, and there are many companies that have agreed to adopt or license Java and use it in their products. So, for example, Microsoft does the browser Internet Explorer, and it also does Java applets. So when we write Java programs, we'll be using the Java Development Kit, so-called JDK. Actually, I think we're going to be running version 1.0.2. There will be a Java compiler. There's Java Source that you can look at and lots of examples. The Applet Viewer for debugging, and some other tools. JDK 1.1 has come out, but it has a lot of interesting features, including some nice things for the Abstract Windowing Toolkit. But it doesn't run on all the browsers yet, so we decided not to switch to JDK 1.1 for this course. We probably won't. We're not expecting to change over probably until the summer. So, as I said, Java has been very popular, and one of the evidence of that is there have been so many books come out about Java. And I have a list of some here. This is just a few of the many that you can find if you go down to Borders or Barnes & Noble and take a look at the Java section. Let me skip over some of these and talk. The third one there, Java in a Nutshell, is one that I use quite a lot. I think it's a good reference work. It talks about more of the classes than a lot of the other books, but it doesn't give us much explanation. The Java Programming Language is an interesting book. One of the authors is James Gosling, who was the primary developer of Java. And if you want to read sort of about the language design issues, this is a really good book for that. This is similar to the original Java white paper that they wrote and that was on the web for so long, and they developed it and put it into this book. It doesn't cover all the kinds of classes there are, but it really talks a lot about the design. There's a book that was written locally, Java Primer Plus. Here's this book at the bottom, Java How to Program by Dital and Dital, is another one that I've been using. It has a lot more explanation. It starts with beginning programming concepts, so if you don't have a strong C or C++ background, this might be a good book for you. It doesn't assume that you know a lot of that stuff. And it seems to cover pretty well all the kinds of classes for windowing and networking that we will probably be wanting to do. Now, there's a series from Sunsoft Press about Java. There are 5 books in this series. I'll skip over the first 3, which I don't consider. They have some good explanations, but they don't cover all the kinds of classes that I think we would want to use. So if you wanted a really good book, I think Core Java would be good. I've used that as well, and it has some good explanations, and it's pretty good about covering everything. Graphics Java is interesting if you're really more serious about doing user interfaces and windowing. It has some new classes that weren't in the original JDK for doing more advanced windowing type stuff. And some of you who, if you were in CPS 606 last semester, that might be another thing you might want to do is take a look at some of the classes in Graphics Java to kind of expand your Java repertoire. There are things like buttons that you can put images on, and new menu bar classes, and rubber banding for selecting things on the window, and so on. me say just a word about Java compared to JavaScript. So Java is a general purpose language that you compile. JavaScript is a similar language. It doesn't have quite the same syntax and concepts that you write directly into your HTML pages. So this is language is interpreted right at the client. And it's a good thing for doing rapid prototyping of user interfaces. And I'm not going to talk more about the differences because you're going to be covering that in this class in the next section. They're both are object-oriented or object-based languages. Now, when Java was designed in the original Java white paper, a lot of the design principles or features of Java were described by James Gosling and Henry McGilson. These are the list of the main features, and let me try to go over them fairly briefly. So the first feature is that it's simple and familiar. And the reason that it's familiar is if you know C or C++, it's based on that language. A lot of the syntax is familiar, a lot of the other features. However, it is simpler than C++ because a lot of the confusing features have been taken out. Operator overloading has been taken out. There are no pointers or type coercions or multiple inheritance. In some ways, it's simpler to program in because Java has built-in mechanisms to handle memory allocation. So you don't have to do malloc to get memory whenever you need it on the fly. The memory is created for you, and then there's an automatic garbage collector which gets rid of the memory, so you don't have to worry about that when you're programming in Java. The other way in which it's simpler is that they kept the main part of the language as simple, as small as possible, so that the kernel is very small. This was a real important feature to them because, remember, they were designing for consumer appliances where you'd want to have a really small kernel. And then all the power of the language comes from all the classes which are defined. Since it's object-oriented, you can define more data structures and more functionality by providing this large library of classes. So that's where the power of the Java comes from, because of its object-oriented character. There are some 250 public classes that come with the Java language in its in the release that we're working with, and more classes are being designed, as well as what to officially go with the language, as well as what other people write. Another way in which the object-oriented nature of Java affects its use on the web is that in an object-oriented language, each programming module that you write is called a class, and in Java, they associate each one of those with a file and do the so they associate the program structure with the file structure of a web server so that it's really easy to write URLs to access Java programs. That's all sort of built into the naming structure. The next feature of Java is that it's architecture neutral. Many languages have the problem that when you use them on different machines, you have very different code generated. You have to recompile things for different machines. And Java tries to tackle this problem by having this intermediate step where you compile code, intermediate code called the bytecodes, which are the same for every machine, so that you the compilers, which are hard to write and actually which exist on lots of different platforms now, don't necessarily have to be written for as many machines as browsers are written for, that people can access Java applets from. What you have to write on all the browser machines are Java interpreters, which can interpret the bytecodes on particular machines. So they've separated that problem into those two parts. So the Java bytecodes run on a machine that's called the Java Virtual Machine, and it is fully defined. Unlike C or C++, where there's still a flavor of, in the language, there's some dependence on what machine you're running on, for example, how many bytes your integers take, and so on. This is all specified at the level of the bytecode, so that there should be not as many differences in how code runs among different machines. The other thing that, arithmetic was made uniform at the bytecode level. The other thing that was made uniform was the windowing environment, and that's called the Abstract Windowing Toolkit. So there's a part of Java which deals with writing user interfaces and doing windowing, and it has a uniform interface called the Abstract Windowing Toolkit. Then each Java interpreter will map, you know, what the Abstract Windowing Toolkit is doing with the mouse or frames on the window into what the vendor-specific environment is doing, like Macintosh Windows or Windows 95 or Unix, X Windows or something like that. I talked about the fact that Java is partly compiled and partly interpreted. I won't say more about that. It does have features built in for distributed computing over networks. So there are built-in classes for TCP/IP protocols for accessing other machines and files across the network. This is mainly a client-server model. But other models can be also accomplished. Java tries hard to be what's called robust, which is that it tries to eliminate as far as possible the kinds of runtime errors that will occur by having a fairly strict system for having to declare the types of all the variables and that there is compile time type checking. Pointer arithmetic has been eliminated. And it checks array subscripts and so on. As much checking is done as possible. So in some ways, it is more cumbersome to write a program in Java because you have to be sure and declare things and so on. It's not a rapid prototyping language. On the other hand, it's a much safer language, which is really nice if you're going to be running it on other people's machines across the web. So this is part of the security that had to be built into Java. When you think about it, it doesn't seem like a very safe thing to be able to take somebody to sit at your browser and to go out and take a program that somebody arbitrarily wrote and come run it on your machine. I mean, it could be a virus of some sort. So some of the language features that have been put into Java are specifically to eliminate that kind of thing. And that's why there's no pointer arithmetic. There's great care in the language not to give you any constructs that allow you to go outside of the memory space that your program is supposed to have. I mean, most viruses work by getting into the memory of the operating system or some other program where it's not supposed to be. So they've been very secure about that. And so far, for bytecodes that are in this general form, as far as I know, there haven't been any viruses or Trojan horses written. There is the problem that you can write a Java applet that will consume so much CPU on the browser machine that it sort of takes over the machine. So people can write applets like that, but so far nobody has written an applet that I know of that's gone to an arbitrary browser and like erased files on the disk or something really nasty. So the other part of the security, of course, is that the bytecodes are sent across the Internet, which is not exactly your secure medium. So there's the question about whether they've been tampered with. And so that part is also addressed by doing some encoding, and the interpreter has to verify at the other end that the bytecode has not been tampered with. Now, another property that was claimed by the designers of Java is that it would be high performance. And so far, this is one of the properties that has had the least success. Initially, it was about 100 times slower than C running on your browser machine. But there have been some improvements. I think there's a lot of possibility with some of these just-in-time interpreters, so that if you have code that's doing something that's compute-intensive, it's quite likely to have a loop. And the first time through, the interpreter will generate code and save it, so that as you go around the loop, you will have compiled code instead of interpreted code. The other concept that was around to make Java run faster is to allow, in some cases, when you really wanted to have a fast applet, for the compiler to generate machine code, which would be shipped to the browser. But, of course, that raises all sorts of security issues. And so far, there aren't general browsers that allow. That was called native bytecode. And so far, general browsers don't allow that. Another nice feature of the Java language design is that it has threads built in, so it's easy to write multi-threaded applications, having more than one flow of control to deal with events. And we'll be talking about that more later. Okay, so that's the end of the introductory section. I'm going to go to the next section, section 2, and start talking about the language. This is the second part in which we'll talk about, start talking about the actual syntax of the language, how to write some applets, and some of the object-oriented concepts. Then next time we'll start talking about doing some of the windowing type of things, and then we'll finish up with doing some network-type programming. Here are some URLs for some online resources. I think that these are also linked into the class webpage, but you might want to check out directly the website that's at www.javasoft.com to see what is the collection of software that Sun has there. Another interesting site to check out to look at examples is www.gamelon.com, where they've collected hundreds and thousands of Java examples. So now let's talk a little more detail about the practical side of writing a Java program. And first of all, Java programs come in sort of two forms. We talked about Java is a general purpose language. It can also be used to write interfaces to web pages. And those two forms are slightly different. You write your programs a little bit differently for those two purposes. So the first kind, the general purpose kind, is called a Java application. These are programs that are meant to be standalone programs, like you would normally write a program in C or C++ or Fortran or whatever. You write the entire program, you would compile it, and then run it on your machine. So how you compile these programs for Java is that you write your program into a file that has an extension called .java. Then the main part of the program is written into a main function, which is actually called a method. That's a typo on this slide. It should be the main method. That's the first time I noticed that, which is going to be executed first. So that's similar to C, that there's a main part of the program which will be executed first. So if you want to compile and run this program, which is in a .java file, you run the compiler. It's called Java C. So you say Java C, let me use the mouse here for the pointer, then you give the name of your program .java, it goes away and compiles. It produces a file of the form, if you originally called it myprogram.java, it'll produce a file called myprogram.class. And again, there are some typos here that should be a capital M and a capital P as well. It preserves the name of your program down here on myprogram.class. So that's the compiled version. That's the bytecode produced by the compiler. But then if you're just running this as a standalone program, you then run the interpreter, which is called Java. You say Java and the name of the program, and that executes the bytecodes in the java.class. So it's quite possible to write Java applications which are not dependent on a web server or a browser situation. So this is a C-based language, so our first program is going to be in traditional style called Hello World. Now, since Java is object-oriented, all programs are written as a class. So every program that you write will have this structure where you have the keyword class and you have the name of the program. And then within these curly brackets, you have the body of the program. Now, this is a very simple program. It's just going to have a main function, which when it executes is going to print out on the standard output a message that says, Hello World. So here is the declaration for the main program. It doesn't take any arguments. The body is in curly braces. The function to print is called println. And the print line function, I'm calling it that in Java, it would actually be called a method, is part of a class called out, and that class is part of a package called system. So when you want to address the print line function, you say system.out.println, and that gives its address within a hierarchy of Java classes that are available to be used. So there's always this hierarchical structure that you can build up of collections of classes into packages, and you use this dot notation to address variables and methods which are in classes within this system. Notice that the syntax is very similar to C with the curly braces, the semicolons after every statement. But one main difference is that upper and lowercase matter. So you have to be very careful about that. And in fact, there is a traditional scheme of writing the names of classes and some of the methods by having uppercase on the first letters of some of the parts of the words. And so there is always this upper and lowercase to worry about in Java. Are there any questions about that program? I think it gives you a little bit of the flavor of some of the syntax. So that's just an extremely simple version of a Java application. Now let's look at an equally simple version of a Java applet. So Java applets are classes which are not intended to run as a standalone program, but are intended to be downloaded to the browser and to be run as part of the browser window system. So the browser's already put up a window on somebody's workstation. And essentially, it's going to call this applet like in some other language you would call a subroutine to display part of the browser window. So applets have a little bit different structure. They don't have a main program to be the first thing that's executed, but they have a set of functions or methods which the browser knows it can call to draw something or display something on the browser window. These set of functions have things like init and start for setting up variables, and in particular they have a function or a method called paint, which is one which actually draws things on the browser window. So like we discussed before, the way that you would make an applet is you would write the Java code, run it through the compiler to create the bytecodes. You would get something, if your applet was called myapplet.java, the compiler, which is called Java C, would produce something of the form myapplet.class. Then you would create an HTML file, suppose you called it myapplet.html, and you would have an applet tag which referred to the bytecodes called myapplet.class. Here are some more details about the... Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot to move over this on the window on this other side. You can't see that. Okay. So this is an example similar to what we saw before. Width and height are filled in here. That's the number of pixels that's going to be the area in the browser window that's going to be displayed in by the applet. The codebase attribute is optional. It specifies the directory in which the applet is found, and then the code gives the actual name of the applet, so it should be something.class. If the codebase is not there, then the browser assumes that the applet is found in the same directory as the HTML file. There are other attributes that you can put. There's this alt, something to print in case your browser doesn't recognize the applet tag, name in case you want to give a name to the window area that the applet is controlling. And that way, different applets, or in fact applets in other frames, if you're using frames in Netscape, can refer to each other as places to display things in the same browser window. Align in vSpace and hSpace specify how to line things up with respect to the HTML. Now, another thing that you can do is pass parameters to the applet code. And if you want to do that, after the applet tag, in which you specify all those things, including the name of the code file that you want to have, you can have any number of tags called param for parameter, and it gives a name that you're going to refer to each parameter by, and what the value is as some string. Then in the Java applet, you have a function, a method called getParameter that you can use to look up the values of these different parameters that are passed through. So here's an example of a simple Java applet. And in this particular applet, we do a different way of using the dot notation to refer to names in the program. And that is, if we have lots of names that have the same beginning notation, like here's a package called Java, a package called AWT, and a class called Graphics, if we're going to refer to lots of methods and variables in that class, then we don't want to always be writing java.awt.graphics.drawstring.drawrect. There's a lot of them. So we can say import that entire class, and then we can just refer to names like drawstring without putting a lot of dot notation on that. So again, this is Java, so that we write a class. We're making this a public class in Java. As in other object-oriented languages, if you make something public, it means that people from the outside of this can call it, and that's what we want to do, because we want the browser to be able to call this applet. Now, an applet is not a standalone program. It actually extends another class which defines sort of basic behavior of applets in the browser window called java.applet.applet. And we'll say more of that. This is the subclass mechanism to say extends here. We'll talk more about that when we get to the object-oriented part. Now, the actual main part of this program is a method called paint that's going to paint on the browser window. And in order to paint, this is the declaration of the method. It has an argument which is the context, the graphics context of the browser window that's already been set up. And this context is a member of the class called graphics, so we can use all these methods like drawstring, drawCircle, there's a lot of them, to draw things on the browser window. In this case, we're doing drawstring of a string called Hello World. And in the graphics package, you have to specify where things are going to go by pixel location. So this is at pixel location 525. Now, a lot of the windowing stuff doesn't get down. You don't have to say where things go by pixels, but these particular drawing methods do. So here's an example of a HTML file that will display this applet. I guess I forgot to look on those surveys that you handed in and see how many people. Are there anybody who doesn't know a little bit of HTML? Anybody who has never prepared a web page? Okay. So we made to. Actually, what we're going to do is just give you some example web pages so that you can of a student web page, and you can change it and go from there. We're not going to be doing extensive building of web pages. So this is a simple HTML page. In the body, we have some text. This is just normal text that's interpreted by the browser as a label for the applet. Then there's this applet tag, and it's called Hello World Applet.class and gives an area in which the applet is supposed to execute. So anybody who loads this HTML page into their browser, the applet will also be downloaded from the web server and will run and will display the text Hello World, which is not too exciting because you could have printed Hello World in your HTML. But you can also get your applet, of course, to do lots of other interesting things. Now we're going to go very fast over sort of the basics of the Java language, and we pointed out that it has a lot of similarity to C, that is, you write statements and they have semicolons at the end. You use curly braces to put around blocks for like a begin and end. There are a few differences though, and you declare variables similar to the ways you do in C and so on. One is that characters, instead of being 8-bit ASCII, are 16-bit Unicode because it has a much bigger character set to take account of possible multiple languages and so on. There are more kinds of comments. There's the //, which is everything onto the rest of the line is a comment. There's the usual /*, which begins a comment, and */ ends it. And then there's /*/, which ends with a */, which is a special comment for the Java doc package, which if you put some other kinds of documentation in, will automatically generate those Java formatted APIs and other kinds of documentation for your code. As far as program structure goes, you can put one or more classes in a file. It's called a compilation unit. When you compile that file, it will compile the main class. It will compile any classes which that class is going to use, including the ones in that file or in any other files in the same directory that class is going to call. So in general, you don't have to, if you have a bunch of different classes in an application, you don't have to invoke the compiler multiple times. You just invoke the compiler on the main class, and it goes off and automatically compile everything else if it's necessary. And similarly for the applet, the browser, if there's subsidiary classes used by a main applet, you don't have to specify them all. The browser will automatically download all the classes that it needs. So let's give a few details about variables and expressions and types. There are primitive or simple types, which are types that are built in. There are composite types, which are objects. It's part of the object-oriented part of the language that you can always make a class which is going to create types that you define. Arrays are sort of in between primitive types and objects. We'll discuss those. So the primitive types are, there are four integer types. They're listed there, byte, short, int, long. For floating point, there's float and double. And then there's characters, which, as we mentioned, are 16-bit. If you want to convert things from one type to another, you can do cast. Note that Booleans, there are real Booleans, and they have values called true and false, and you don't represent Booleans by 0 and 1 and minus 1 like you do in some languages, like C. So let's mention what arrays look like. You declare arrays by giving the type of the elements of the array. In this case, suppose we want to create a one-dimensional array of integers. Let's call the name of the array vec. Then the type of the elements here is given as int. And the fact that we put one pair of square brackets indicates that this is a one-dimensional array. So you can put that in the order given here, int vec square brackets, or you can say int square brackets vec. Either of those is fine. Now that just declares the variable vec to have that type, a one-dimensional array whose elements are ints. If you actually want to create that array so that there is storage allocated for it, then you use the keyword called new. You say vec is a new int, and at that point you must specify what the size of the array is going to be. And in this example, 128. Of course, you can combine the declaration and the creation of the array if you wish. So this example showed creating an array of a primitive type, which is int. You can also create arrays of arbitrary composite types or objects. One of the types of objects in Java are threads. So for example, you could create an array of threads by just giving the construct new and then giving the name of the class that you wanted to create as the elements of the array. This is a little bit different from having an array of integers, because when you create the array of integers, since it's a primitive type, each element is an int is already created. When you create a composite type, when you say, create me a vector of threads, it only creates essentially a list of placeholders for the threads. Then for each individual one, you actually have to run the thread constructor, which is going to allocate all the space for that particular thread to have. But we'll be giving examples of that. When you declared a one-dimensional array of length 128, it's subscripted by integers from 0 to 127. These subscripts are range checked at runtime so that you can't say things like vec of minus 1, because the indexing starts at 0. There is a method that you can use on arrays. That's why arrays are partially like classes instead of primitive types. You can say vec.length, I'm sorry, not a method, a variable, which tells you, gives you the length of that array. You can declare arrays, give their size by a variable, which is defined at runtime, the so-called dynamic sizing. Arrays don't change their size during runtime. It's just that the size can be not known until runtime. But once you've declared an array of some size, then it stays that size. There is another data type that can vary in size over the lifetime of the program. So far, the examples we've shown have all been one-dimensional arrays. You get multi-dimensional arrays just by putting more square brackets. And these are actually, it's actually considered to be a one-dimensional array in which each element is itself an array. And you can create so-called ragged arrays in which each of those, in what you would think of as the second dimension, was a different size, for example. Here are some examples of expressions, and I think they should look pretty familiar. There's plus and times. You put parentheses around things to indicate precedence. There's the construct like i++, which is equivalent to I is assigned i+1. There are Boolean things. There are shift things. This question mark might be unfamiliar to some of you. It's a conditional expression. What's on the left of the question mark is the Boolean condition. If it's true, then you execute the true part, and then there's a colon, and then there's the false part that's executed if the expression is false. Okay, so it's similar to the SNL statement, except that instead of statements here, you have expressions. String concatenation is given with plus. It's equivalent to the dot in Perl, and for those of you who know Perl, for concatenating together two strings. If you have a variable and you want to know if it's an instance of a particular class, you have this construct instance of, which is true in exactly that case. My next button doesn't seem to be working. There we go. So here's the first slide on control flow, and it lists a number of statements that you have in Java. There is a conditional statement, if then else, just like in C. You say if, in parentheses you put a Boolean expression. Either you put one statement, or in curly braces you put a part that's the then part. Then you give the keyword else. Then you put what's to be executed in the case the expression is false. In this case, it's another if. There's a while loop, while Boolean expression do some statement or block. There's a for loop, and it's just like in C, so I guess in C++, so I guess I won't go over it. Expression 1 initializes the loop variable. Expression 2, I guess I will go over it, is applied. It's the increment. It's applied at the end of every iteration of the loop. And the loop continues as long as this Boolean expression remains true. There's also a switch statement, which I won't go over. Next in your notes are several slides about continue and break. And let me just briefly mention, these first two show with a for loop that if you say continue, you can jump out of the current iteration of the loop to the next iteration of the loop. If you say break, you can jump out of the current iteration of the loop entirely out of the loop so that you don't execute the loop anymore. And there is a similar thing on the next slide for the switch statement to break out of the first iteration and then to break out of the whole loop. Now, I want to show you some more examples that illustrate the syntax of the language, and it's kind of hard to do that with anything significant because I haven't told you about all the classes that do really fun things like windowing and so on. But let's start with some examples that do some more of the simple graphics, like the drawstring example. So one thing to know is in these examples we're going to be drawing, this is the one case where you draw, you say where, according to some pixel coordinates, things should go in the browser window. As I said before, it's not true of most of the constructs. And in that case, pixels are numbered from the upper left of the part of the browser window that is controlled by the applet. Furthermore, there is a current state associated with this part of the browser window. In particular, there's a current font and a current color. So here's an example where we're going to do the Hello World example, only we're going to say hello again in a different font in a different color. And the thing about fonts and colors is, like almost everything in Java except for the primitive types, they're classes. So if you want to declare a font, here's the same structure for having an applet. And within this applet, we have a variable declared, F, which is of type font. At the same time as we do the declaration, we do the initialization, we say new, and in order to create something of type font, you give a method that's called a constructor, which has the same name. Okay? So whenever you write a class that's going to be creating structures of some sort, you will write a method of the same name, which is called the constructor that's going to do that. The constructor for fonts take a bunch of parameters in which you can pick one of a list of fonts, what style it is and what size it is, to set it up. So now we have F set up as a font, which is Times Roman, bold, 36. So in fact, if we were doing a complex user interface, we would probably set up sort of several standard fonts to be used at different places in our user interface. Now my paint program can change the font by, there's a method called setFont, I change it to F. I also have a method called setColor, which will change the current color. And in this case, I didn't have to create a new color because there are a bunch of standard colors built in as variables in the class called color. So there's color.red, color.black, color.white. You can just use those without having to create new ones. So in this case, we did red. And then when we draw the string, it comes out in a big font, and it comes out red. I could show you that, but I'm running out of time. Let's go on to some of the other things. So here's an example that's drawing some shapes. So there are a bunch of methods in the graphics class. There is drawRect, which draws a rectangle that is just the border of the rectangle. There's fillRect, which draws a rectangle but fills in the interior. So in this example, well, first of all, I actually declared a new color, and I created it by using a color constructor which accepts RGB values in the range of 0 to 255 to tell me what are the mix of colors this should be. So you can design any color that you want using RGB values. So I set the color to be green. I make a filled rectangle, which is green. The result of this applet is shown down at the bottom. Then I set the color to be black, and I draw the same rectangle, only without being filled. And that puts this one pixel border around this. So one of the things that you notice is that when you, in the drawing part of this program, in the graphics package, as you keep drawing things, it just puts them up on top of each other. So you just keep building up things that you've drawn. They just go right on top. And then I finally did a circle by doing this filled oval of this color that I created is actually magenta. Here's an example of an applet that passes parameters. In this one, there's a parameter which has a name. I gave it a value of my own, Nancy. And I wanted to show you this applet. In this applet, I have two methods. There's another standard method which I can have called init, in which I can do any initial kind of, well, any initializations to variables and things that I want to do. And so in this case, I have a variable declared in my applet called name, which is a string, and I can get that string by calling the method getParameter to be the value of the parameter that was passed on the HTML page. So this should be the name, the string Nancy, if it's run with that HTML page that we just saw in the previous one. This actually tests, and if they didn't put a parameter, it inserts the name Laura, then it constructs a string that says either hello Nancy or hello Laura, and then the paint method draws that. There's another applet here which does something a little trickier, which uses methods which get you the width and height of the browser window in order to calculate how to center a string in the window. And I'm not going, I'll leave that for you to check out in any kind of detail. Here's a list of the functions that you can define when you're the standard methods for applets. There's init, which is executed once when the applet is downloaded. There's start, which is executed each time the browser window is re-entered. Because you have to be prepared for the fact that if people like close the browser window, then you want the applet to be stopped. And when the browser window is opened again, then the applet is restarted. So there's this difference between the time when the applet is downloaded, which is once, and the time that the applet is started, which might be more than once, depending on what people are doing with the browser window. Or they might be moving over other frames on top of the browser window and so on. And it needs to refresh, it needs to restart the applet to refresh the window. Paint, of course, is executed every time you want to draw. And then stop and destroy have similar meaning to start and init. There are two other methods, repaint and update, which are used as you change the contents of the browser window. And again, we'll be going over those in more detail later. And then I have two more examples here of applets. This one draws a set of boxes, and I wanted to show this example to illustrate the use of some methods from the math package. So in fact, in this particular example, there are two for loops to create a grid of boxes, and in each iteration of the loop, there are three calls to math.random to get a random number. These random numbers come between 0 and 1, so they are resized to be between 0 and 255 by multiplying here. Then they're converted to integers by taking math.floor. This example actually then casts them to be int, and I believe that's unnecessary because math.floor will produce an integer. But this is just to make sure. So these three values are then taken to be their integers. They're called rval, gval, and bval. And they're given as the arguments to create a new color. So this is just a color created out of three random numbers. And then it's used to draw colored rectangles. I can show you this applet running. And it creates lots of brown, as you might suppose, when you mix colors together like that. I gave one more version that does, this is the applet, appears the same, but I did it in a different, actually more inefficient way, just to illustrate the use of arrays. So in this applet, there are three arrays created that are two-dimensional, and these three arrays will have the three color numbers for each of those boxes. So first, there's a loop which uses random and to create three color numbers, and here is the assignment to individual elements of the array. So if we have an array called color underbar r, we can just index it with I and j, that gives a particular element, and we can assign it some integer. So that shows assignment to elements of arrays. And then of course down here there's another loop which goes through and accesses the elements of the array and uses it to create a number and draw the rectangle. So that illustrates the use of arrays. I wanted to start the Java object model tonight, but I think I'm going to have to stop here. I believe class is over at 8:25. It's supposed to be over at 8:20, but you're supposed to have an extra 5 minutes every night because of Martin Luther King Day, right? So 8:25. We have to get in our contact minutes. I shouldn't say these things. I'm still recording. So I showed you your homework assignment. I gave you web address of the class page, and the homework assignment will be linked in tomorrow. Mehmet and I will get together and fix that. The Java examples that I showed in the lecture will also be linked in so that you can see them. If anyone is interested, they're under the same web address, except it's ecs400spring96/java in all caps. Instead of this, you... Almost all the Java examples are linked into your class page, except for these particular ones, and we'll get those fixed up. I have one more announcement, or actually I have two more announcements. The first is that originally there was a class called CPS 714, which was supposed to do more advanced web projects, and it was canceled. It's now been reopened. So I don't know, this class is supposed to be the prerequisite for that class, so probably none of you are going to be taking it, but you might be eligible, or you might know of someone who was interested in that, and so I want to tell you that that class has been reopened. It will be done essentially as an independent study. You meet once a week in Jeffrey Fox's office and plan out your projects. The other announcement is that if anyone tried to register for this course and was closed out, it has also been reopened, so please do go and get registered so that we have an accurate count of what we need. Now, is there anyone who didn't see the class list that was passed around?